From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Edward Hacksaw Jones escaped from prison 14 times in 20 years. His photo used to be on the FBI's most wanted list. Now it's on the dust jacket of his books. Jones was released from prison in 1990. He talks with us on today's Fresh Air. From prison to Aspen, journalist Ted Conover spent 2 years in this town that's become a retreat for celebrities and rich people. He crashed Don Johnson's party, worked on John Denver's Christmas special, and thought a lot about the insular world of celebrities. Coming up, he tells us how he was almost seduced by it. And book critic John Leonard reviews On Mozart, the new novel from Anthony Burgess. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House Chief of Staff John Sununu submitted his resignation today, saying he thought it was in President Bush's best interest. The announcement ended weeks of speculation about a White House shakeup and put to rest criticism by Republicans who feared the president was receiving bad advice from his chief of staff. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The former New Hampshire governor came to Washington in 1988 as chief of staff to President Bush. He was credited for Bush's come-from-behind victory in the pivotal New Hampshire primary. His abrasive style alienated cabinet members and congressmen, and his excessive use of government planes and limousines raised eyebrows both outside and inside the administration. But the continued economic slump and the perception that Sununu was advising the president against launching any new economic growth plans mobilized Republicans to demand his removal. Speaking to reporters in Mississippi today, Sununu said he had told the president if he became a political burden, he would leave. He said the president doesn't need an extra political target during the upcoming campaign. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela said today that international economic sanctions should be maintained against South Africa until apartheid has been ended. Mandela was at the United Nations to speak before its annual debate on South Africa. He said that sanctions should be lifted only gradually as South Africa moves first to an interim government, then to an elected government based on a non-racial constitution. The ANC, South Africa's white minority government, and other anti-apartheid groups are set to begin talks on a new constitution on December 20th. Freed hostage Alan Steen has arrived in Germany after being released early today in Beirut. There are growing signs the final hostage, Terry Anderson, might follow him. Deirdre Berger has more from Frankfurt.
Alan Steen walked erectly off a U.S. military plane in Frankfurt tonight at Rhein-Main Air Force Base, wearing a thick hooded jacket to protect him from frigid temperatures in Germany. He was greeted by an honor guard and the U.S. ambassador to Germany before being whisked by car to a U.S. Air Force medical center in Wiesbaden. There, he will join former fellow hostage Joseph Sisipio, who spent the day undergoing medical exams and dental work. Sisipio's doctor says he is in relatively good shape, except for occasional bouts of dizziness and permanent frostbite damage on his fingers and toes. The doctor says Sisipio told him he was chained to an outdoor balcony for two winter seasons. Both former hostages are expected to stay at the Wiesbaden Medical Center several days before returning home to the U.S. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 6 points to close at 2,929.56. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 187 million shares. This is NPR News. Despite the fact that President Bush's popularity has fallen sharply, a new poll released today showed the president would easily beat New York Governor Mario Cuomo in a presidential election. The poll was conducted by the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press. It showed that the president would beat the governor by 58% to 37% in a test election, with 5% undecided. A coalition of consumer, environmental, and public health groups handed out its annual Lemon Awards today for what it views as the most misleading or irresponsible ad campaigns of 1991. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
R.J. Reynolds picked up a Lemon Award for its Camel cigarette ads, which sport a hip-looking camel with dark shades and a cigarette dangling from its mouth. The Coalition for Smoking and Health charges that these ads are directly aimed at teenagers. Hasbro Toys was also a Lemon recipient for its electronic survivor shot adventure game. The ads promise kids they'll feel the sensation of being shot, but it takes two guns to make the game work, and the guns are sold separately.
To send you the thing all by itself will mean there were some very unhappy children at the holiday time if their parents didn't go out and buy one of these. It is a useless $71.95.
The dubious winners also included Stroh's Company for its Old Milwaukee ads featuring the Swedish bikini team, commercials viewed by the presenters as insulting to women. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The president's chief economic advisor sought to reassure business people today that the recession has been a mild one, but he acknowledged that the economy is likely to remain sluggish over the next few months. Michael Boskin told an Agriculture Department conference that what he called a modest recovery had slowed in the past few months. He cited three factors, however, that could spur economic growth: low inflation, lower interest rates, and low inventories in U.S. warehouses. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Edward Jones has gone under many aliases, but he got his nickname, Hacksaw, from the FBI. Jones is a convicted burglar who escaped from prison 14 times in 20 years. He spent some time on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. During his last years in prison, he turned to writing. His autobiography, Hacksaw, was published in 1988. 2 years later, he was released from prison. Now he's completed his third crime novel about a former convict turned amateur detective. It's called Stoneface. Jones' escape record lengthened his time in prison. He spent very little of his adult life on the outside.
My original charge, I was 17 years old. I was in Richmond, Virginia. And the charge at that time was grand larceny by possession, which is now called just simply possession of stolen goods. I had bought a stolen wedding ring for my childhood sweetheart. We were both 17, decided to run away and get married. And we did get married, and I didn't have a ring at the time to give her. And I was working at a place that made sinkers and fish hooks. And one of my coworkers had a little small diamond ring, and he sold it to me for $35. So a week later, she was in downtown Richmond and stopped in at a pawn shop because she wanted to see if it was a real diamond in there, I think. It was just a little small diamond. And they had it on their, what they call their hot sheet. And that night, a detective came by and talked to me about it. And I said, yes, I had given it to her. And I was arrested, charged with grand larceny by possession. I was given 10 years and 2 years suspended on a chain gang. That was it.
Were there any other crimes you were convicted of other than breaking out of prison?
Over the years?
Yeah.
Yes. I've never made any excuse. Well, I did at first make some excuses, but I've never pulled any punches about my culpability, as it were. I have committed crimes. At the time that I, not, if you want to call them serious or non-serious, whatever, they were still crimes. I have committed probably about three burglaries, mostly for clothes and food when I was on the run. I did, in Las Vegas, committed a burglary to get some money to get out of town. And let's see, I conspired with a jeweler in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in 1976 to make it appear that he had been robbed. This was in order so that he could defraud his insurance company, which was Lloyd's of London.
Now, the first time that you broke out of prison was during your first 10-year sentence of hard labor. You were on a chain gang, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Before the first time you broke out, someone else from your chain gang had attempted to escape, but he was shot by a guard.
Right.
Why didn't that discourage you from breaking out yourself?
Well, quite opposite from discouraging me, I think it encouraged me, because the person who was shot happened to be a friend of mine. His name was Tugboat Adams. Tugboat Adams, and he was nicknamed Tugboat because of the fact that he was built like a tugboat and was primarily the bull of the camp. But he really wasn't a bad guy, except the guards were really scared of him. And one day out on the road, one particular guard was getting his goat and had been pretty well riding him the whole day, accusing him of dragging and slow work and all of this, that, and the other. And at lunchtime, Tugboat was really mad, and he was sitting on a stump eating his sandwich, and he asked to, um, he asked to urinate. And then when you do that, you just kind of stand up, walk a few paces away, and turn your back. And, of course, the guard let him. And Tug just made a break for the wood line. And as he did, he was wearing chains. He was wearing leg irons. And as he did, the leg irons caught on a little stob that was in the ground, a little piece of a bush that had been cut, and it tripped him. And just as he went down, the guard fired the first shot, and the first shot missed him. And Tugboat rolled over and sat up, and he looked at the guard, and the guard looked at him, and then he shot him. Basically, I think what this did is it just angered me more than anything else, and it kind of reinforced my belief of what was happening at that particular time in the state of Virginia and probably other states as well with these chain gangs. So it only encouraged me to just want to get out of there.
So how did you escape that first time?
The first time, I was wearing a set of leg irons, and we were piling brush out on the road. And I had been given 30 days in the hole a short time before that. And the reason why was because I had had a fight with the dog boy, and this was after Tugboat had been killed, because the dog boy ended up with a pair of his tennis shoes. And I was put in the hole for it, and while I was in the hole, I rubbed through one of the links on my leg irons till it was just practically all the way through. It was only a sliver holding it. And packed the crevice with some soap and rubbed a little dirt on it. And when I went out on the road after I was back in the basement on the work crew, and I went out on the road, it was about the third day, I believe, that I was out. And when the guard had his back turned for a few seconds, I popped the chain and hit the wood line, which was about 20 yards away. And, of course, no one expected me to move that fast because I had leg irons on and didn't realize that the chain had been broken.
So this is one of those classic escapes where you spent days and days and days rubbing the chain against concrete to file it down.
About 3 weeks.
What do you think of as being your most ingenious escape?
I don't think any of them have been ingenious. They were more acts of desperation at the time. And a lot of times you feel like you have to make something happen. In other words, you sit around and you wait and you look and you hope that in this particular situation, in a prison environment I'm talking about, and you obviously want to be released, you hope for parole or you hope for good behavior or whatever. And when that doesn't come, you know, it's a tremendous letdown. So then you you start thinking about other ways to get out. At least I did. And the driving force behind my escape was I just didn't want to be there. I didn't like either crowd. I didn't like the prisoners I was with, and I didn't like the guards who were keeping me. So it was a question of where I just have to get out of here.
But time and time again, you'd get recaptured and brought back. So it's, I don't know, it would seem to me it would start to feel futile after a while.
I was never a very good fugitive, especially at the beginning. It was kind of like on-the-job training. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything about obtaining false identification, et cetera, anything like that. And, you know, there are no schools that teach this stuff. So it was a process of trial and error, and mostly when I got out, I did try to find legitimate work, and I found a lot of legitimate work while I was on escape. But it just seemed like something always happened, and I don't call it fate, call it stupidity. Certain instances I could call it stupidity on my part, but it just seemed like something always happened, and I ended up right back in their clutches.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Jones, and he escaped from prison 14 times. Now he's actually out of prison, and he's become a writer in the past few years. He has written several books, including an autobiography called Hacksaw. He's also just published his third crime novel, and it's called Stoneface. One of your breakouts that really relied on your abilities as a con man was the time that you convinced FBI agents that you were going to lead them to a secret stash of stolen jewels. And what you were really leading them to was a gun that you had buried, a gun that actually didn't work, but they didn't know that. So while they were looking for the jewels, you were unburying the gun and then held them up and escaped.
That's true, but actually it was the other way around. They convinced me to do that.
They convinced you to
take them
out there.
Uh-huh. Right. This wasn't anything that I had concocted originally or planned right from square one. I'd kind of like to take credit for that if it was that good. But what had happened was that I had been arrested for this purported jewel robbery in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with a jeweler by the name of Joseph Sergani. He had accused me of robbing him of $1.2 million in jewelry. When they arrested me, the FBI, along with the prosecuting attorney's office, Broward County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, were convinced that I had been involved in a whole rash of jewel thefts in the South Florida area. In fact, they even told the news media that I was probably the biggest jewel thief in Florida. And yet I had never even been accused of another jewel thief, much less been convicted of one jewel theft, I'm sorry. But every day they would come to my cell and try to convince me to tell them where all this jewelry was and the rest of the jewelry from the Joseph Sergani robbery, quote unquote. Because Joseph Sergani had actually said that twice as much jewelry was missing than actually he had. So after about 5 days of this, I decided that maybe they would agree to just take me out because they wanted to find some jewelry so bad. So I figured maybe if I agreed with them, went along with them, said, okay, I'll take you to where the stuff is, maybe I could get them back to Georgia where there was a gun. And the gun was off of a wooded, well, it was in a wooded area off of a secondary road outside of Atlanta. And I had thrown it in a junk pile. This was a gun that Joseph Sergani himself had given me when we conspired to do this robbery. And there were no bullets in it. The firing pin was broken. It could not have worked if you'd wanted it to, if it was a life or death situation. And consequently, that's exactly the reason why I threw it out there. It's useless. But I remembered this, and this wild idea in my head, I wondered if a couple of them would take me out and I could possibly lead them there and pull this gun on them. And lo and behold, that's basically what they did. But they had six officers, and I wasn't expecting six. But that's how that happened. It wasn't initiated by me, and I just took advantage of the situation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Jones, and he was in prison for many years, escaped 14 times, which made him famous or infamous, and now he's really out, and he's become a writer in the past few years. He's written several books, including the autobiography Hacksaw, and a series of crime novels. The new crime novel is called Stoneface. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Edward Jones is my guest, and he's written a new novel called Stoneface, a crime novel. You were released in 1990.
Uh-huh.
How did you actually manage to get released?
I was paroled. In fact, it was an interesting situation. While I was in prison these later years, I had made up my mind in 1980 I was not going to escape ever again. But at the same time, I realized that I had to do something. And since I couldn't channel my energies into escaping anymore, I tried to channel them into writing. I received a lot of support from people, encouragement and whatnot, and I really enjoyed it. But after I wrote Hacksaw and had just finished writing an epilogue to it, as a matter of fact, my cell was searched by a couple of correctional officers. They confiscated the entire manuscript and the epilogue, and I was later called into the warden's office and told that he was confiscating the epilogue. And when I asked why, he said that it was contrary to the orderly running and security of the institution because I had drastically criticized them, and which was true. I was also warned not to write another epilogue. I did write another epilogue, and I sent it to my attorney. My attorney consequently sent it on to my publisher. And it was printed, and I was placed in Marion solitary confinement for 2.5 years behind that and was ordered not to write anymore, and I continued writing. I filed a lawsuit against them and in Washington, D.C., and a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. agreed that I did have a valid cause and remanded it to the district court for prosecution. The Bureau of Prisons then came to me and said if I'd agree to dismiss the lawsuit against them, they would transfer me to any prison I wanted to go to for the rest of my time, which was about 18 months left at that time. And I did agree. All of this is in court documents. So it's what they literally did was use solitary confinement as their own personal punishment chamber to kind of coerce me into dismissing a lawsuit against them.
I'm surprised that you were paroled after so many prison breaks.
Well, actually, the parole board or the parole commission, they have what's called a notice of action that they send all inmates after you appear before them. And the notice of action tells you whether they're going to parole you, whether they're going to reduce your minimum time, or whether they're going to deny you parole at that time, or whatever it is that they're going to do. In my notice of action, after I went to the parole commission, after I began writing, this was several years later, they sent me a notice of action taking a year off of my guidelines, a year off of which I would normally had to do, according to their calculations, for writing. They rewarded me for this. They specifically made reference to that. And on the other hand, as I said, the United States Bureau of Prisons, even at that time, had me in solitary confinement charged with a disciplinary infraction code 408, which is the code number for it, for doing it. So I had two government agencies, one condemning me and punishing me, and one rewarding me for doing the same thing.
Why did you give up trying to break out in 1980?
It's just, it got so old. You know, you undergo burnout. Also, I was in my late 30s. You know, there comes a point in life where, for all of us, whether we're inmates or non-inmates, where, you know, we examine where we've been, where we are, and where we want to go. And, you know, it usually occurs around age 40. And it was that way with me, and I was really doing some deep soul searching, deep thinking. And I didn't want to do this. I really did not want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had had a conversation with my mother at about that time too, where I promised her I was going to give it another shot, another way, and I did.
Your new novel, Stoneface, is about a character who is psychopathically brutal. I mean, he is just not fazed at all by brutality. Is he based on somebody who you knew in prison?
Practically all my characters, at least the male characters, are based on either on someone I knew in prison or compilations thereof of several people. There are a lot of characters in prison. I've had 30 years of character exposure. And yes, they're very real. They are not invented characters by any stretch of the imagination other than the name attributed to them and perhaps some of the actions. But by and large, these are the personalities that we're dealing with. People who would rather kill as a first option than a second.
I have to ask you, I think this is correct, that you wrote a screenplay that sold for six figures?
That's true.
Yeah. So now that you're dealing with, you know, meetings in the publishing world and the movie world, do you find that there are aspects of having been something of a con man yourself that you can use in selling yourself now, which you have to do in publishing and in movies? You have to sell yourself, and you have to be able to talk a good line about whatever it is that you're writing.
Well, to begin with, I kind of like to clarify this title, you know, this con man, so to speak. This was the FBI talking, not anybody else. The FBI was furious at me because of the incident over the jewels, so to speak, because of the fact that I did handcuff their agents and left them out in the woods and disabled one of their cars and drove away.
Right.
This is a very unsettling thing. It upset them a lot, obviously, and they were very, very outraged. So let's take it with a grain of salt when someone like the FBI accuses me of being a con man. I didn't start out being a con man. I have never been a con man per se. Everything that I've done has been pretty well up front. If anybody is really upset at me for escaping from what I consider literally an unjust system, then and they want to call me a con man by utilizing certain measures and doing that, that's fine.
Do you feel adjusted yet to life outside?
I'm still getting adjusted to it. No, I'm not totally adjusted. I walked out of solitary confinement. I didn't just walk out of prison. I walked out of a 5x8 cell that I had spent a year and a half in, and I'm talking about at San Diego at that time, after spending 2.5 years in Marion. So I had 4 years of solitary confinement when I walked out onto the streets at 6:15 in the morning, and it was still dark, and I was afraid to cross the street. And as it turned out, some people who were picking me up showed up a little late, arrived a little late. I had to wait about 5 minutes. And I think that was probably the most discombobulating 5 minutes of my life, because people passing by, you're literally outside. I'm wondering when someone's going to step out the shadows and grab me, this type of thing. And yeah, it was a great culture shock. And there's still a certain amount of culture shock. I went through a lot of changes when I first got out, and it's difficult. It's very difficult. It's hard to explain, but it's like you have to shed everything that you've experienced over the last 2 or 3 decades in order to survive. And you have to shed all of that, and you have to conform totally to society, to the society that you're in. And you have to handle things differently. You've got 911 now. You can't, in prison, you don't have 911. You're expected to take care of bruised shins and other tragedies by yourself. So it's, and you deal with people, even the little things like paying for my first meal. I almost didn't pay for it. I almost walked out without paying for it. Not because I was trying to stiff anybody. I just didn't think about it. How many years have I been eating free food? I've never had to pay for this stuff. Things like that. It takes an effort, and some getting over.
How do you think that you've been changed by the many years that you spent in prison? Is there any way of judging that?
How I've changed?
Yeah, how you were changed by it.
I don't think I was changed by it. Prison never changed me, not basically from who I was at first or who I am now. I'm still basically the same person who went into prison at 17 years of age. What it has done, it's educated me. It's because I do think that I observe things. I keep my eyes open. I like to look at things. I like to look at people. I like to know what's going on most of the time if I can. In prison, I learned what's going on.
After all your years in solitary, do you want to live alone now?
No. In fact, I don't live alone. I have a fiancé. And we live together. We're going to be married in the very near future. In fact, we're working out the details now, or the timing. No, I don't want to be alone, but I do want, I am very choosy about who I am with, because of the simple fact that I just don't feel comfortable with everyone. And that's my problem. And it's a problem that I've been working on, and I probably will continue to work on.
I really wish we had more time to talk, but we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Edward Jones' new crime novel, Stoneface, is published by Donald Fine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Ted Conover hopped freights for his book about hobos rolling nowhere. And he lived and worked with illegal immigrants from Mexico for his book Coyotes. His next book seemed like a lark. He was going to immerse himself in the culture of Aspen, Colorado, a playground for the rich and famous. Coming up, Ted Conover tells us how he went to Aspen as a skeptic and stayed too long. And book critic John Leonard reviews On Mozart, a new surreal novel about the composer by Anthony Burgess. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Ending weeks of speculation, White House Chief of Staff John Sununu has resigned. Critics have blamed the Chief of Staff for some of the confusion over the president's economic policies and his sometimes abrasive manner in dealing with people. Earlier, Sununu had been the subject of an ethics probe for his wide use of government airplanes and cars. Mr. Bush says that his chief of staff will stay on as special advisor until the 1st of March with rank of cabinet member. According to reports from the Middle East, Terry Anderson, the last U.S. hostage held in Lebanon, could be freed as early as tomorrow. Newly released Alan Steen says that he heard Anderson would be released by the end of this week. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
The imminent release of hostages is usually preceded by a statement to that effect by their kidnappers. In Terry Anderson's case, Islamic Jihad, the pro-Iranian group that seized him in March 1985. If he's free tomorrow, Anderson will be the third American released in as many days, part of an exchange deal sponsored by the United Nations, where Israel will free hundreds of Lebanese prisoners in return. Anderson, who's 44, was the Associated Press's bureau chief in Beirut, covering Lebanon's civil war and the plight of other hostages when he was kidnapped. His six-year-old daughter, Salome, who he's never met, and her Lebanese mother, Madeline, have left their home in Cyprus for Damascus for an emotional reunion. But the West's hostage file can only be closed when two German relief workers are also freed. But that's looking increasingly likely after Iran made a public appeal to those holding them. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
In New York City, the UN General Assembly has elected Boutros Ghali of Egypt as the new UN Secretary General. NPR's Jim Zeroli has more.
The 69-year-old Egyptian official was elected unanimously to a five-year term. He will take office January 1st, succeeding Javier Perez de Cuellar. In his first major address since his nomination last month, Boutros Ghali said that as Secretary General, he would promote peace and security and try to spur development in the Third World. He said the UN Charter is as valid today as it was at the organization's founding in 1945.
I call for the cooperation and assistance of all who can help to transform the noble objectives of the Charter into a reality.
In remarks certain to please the Bush administration, Boutros Ghali also said he would work to eliminate waste and obsolescence at the UN. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 6 points to close at 2,929.56. on volume of some 187 million shares. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Soviet President Gorbachev has warned of civil unrest if the Soviet Union breaks apart. The Soviet leader called the state crisis the worst problem facing his country, and he called on all parliaments in the various Soviet republics to approve a proposed Union of Sovereign States treaty. He also said that a breakup of the Soviet Union would hurt science, culture, and the security of the Soviet people. In West Palm Beach, Florida, one of the chief prosecution witnesses took the stand today in the William Kennedy Smith trial. Doug Phillips reports.
Ann Mercer is a friend of the woman who says she was raped by Smith. She appeared tense and nervous, testifying she was with her friend at a trendy Palm Beach bar when the woman met Smith, danced with him, and later agreed to give him a ride home. Mercer told prosecutor Maura Lash she was home, readying for bed when the telephone rang. It was her friend.
Can you describe her demeanor on the phone to you? just hysterical. What did she say to you? That she had been raped?
Mercer said she and her boyfriend went to the Kennedy home and found the woman shaking uncontrollably and crying. Mercer is this trial's ninth witness, the first to tell jurors the prosecution's version of what happened last March 30th at the Kennedy estate. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in West Palm Beach.
In London, Kevin and Ian Maxwell have resigned their executive positions with Maxwell Communications in order to avoid conflicts of interest while the company's financial affairs are looked into. This step was taken after a meeting today with some 30 banking officials who are owed more than $1.5 billion. Since their father's death at sea last month, the Maxwell brothers have struggled to reorganize the companies and to restructure their debt. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Aspen, Colorado has become a retreat for the rich and famous. Journalist Ted Conover says it represents a problem in American culture. Very successful and wealthy individuals are virtually seceding from the rest of society. Conover's new book, Whiteout, is based on the 2 years he spent living in Aspen. He worked for a cab company, a caterer, and a local newspaper. He crashed Don Johnson's party, worked on John Denver's Christmas special, joined the health club where Jane Fonda works out, and tried to locate the God within him at New Age therapy groups. Not exactly the lifestyle he was used to. Conover rode the rails with hobos for his earlier book, Rolling Nowhere. And he traveled with illegal immigrants from Mexico for his book Coyotes. I wondered why he went from writing about the disenfranchised to the wealthy elite.
I thought it would be a good thing for me to look at the other side of the coin. And I also think Aspen is representative of a trend in American culture. It's part of a movement of well-educated, upper middle-class urbanites, not toward suburbs, which were the lodestone in the 50s and 60s, but toward smaller towns, college towns and resort towns in particular, because they offer some of the cosmopolitan setting of cities without most of the ills of cities. And in the case of Aspen, this seemed to me to represent a sort of problem in terms of the creation of an elite enclave of people insulated from the world struggle. So I thought Aspen had held out all sorts of possibilities that were very much in line with the sorts of things I had written about before.
It's very expensive to live in Aspen, and a lot of people who live there or who go there are celebrities. And you're right that celebrities first started coming for beauty and charm, and then they started going to take a vacation from being celebrities. Do you think that there's a celebrity class in America and that the celebrity class likes to be in places where they can hang out with other celebrities in a kind of celebrity-protected environment?
I do, and Aspen's very celebrity-friendly in terms of being full of people who will not come up to you for an autograph if you're Don Johnson, who will not stare at you in the boutique if you're Jane Fonda, just out shopping. You can be a celebrity there, and as far as it seems possible, just be a regular person. I mean, that is possible to some degree in Aspen. The change over the last few years, however, is that before, celebrities really could come to Aspen for a vacation, and now it's sort of another stop on the celebrity circuit, especially in the week between Christmas and New Year's, when there are more than you can shake a stick at, and they're there to be seen as well as just to enjoy the beauty and the comforts of Aspen.
Is this particularly true of stars who are on their way up or on their way down and need to be seen?
The ones on their way up are the ones who come to be seen. The ones on the way down often are the ones who live there. In a way, you can, it's sort of like you can go out to pasture in Aspen if you're a little past your peak, if you are Jill St. John or John Denver, George Hamilton, someone without all the intense interest that you might have attracted in past years. Aspen's a very pleasant retreat.
This book represents, in a way, a change of class for you. I mean, you're from the middle class.
Right.
But for your first couple of books, you wrote about people who were disenfranchised. You wrote about hobos. You wrote about illegal immigrants from Mexico.
Right.
suddenly, okay, you're still middle class, but you're writing about people who are really wealthy.
Yes.
And who are, in some instances, celebrities to boot. So now you were the comparatively disenfranchised one.
Right.
Was there a lot of, like, class confusion for you during this period?
Yes, there is. You know, I've always thought of myself as someone to whom issues of social justice and things like that were important. In Aspen, I went with a certain chip on my shoulder, thinking I will approach Aspen from the working class point of view. But to my surprise, the longer I was there, the more I found I really, really liked it. And people were really nice to me. I was a young writer. I mean, unlike with Mexican guys, I fit right in Aspen. And I started enjoying it a great deal. And in fact, had planned to spend only a year, ended up spending 2 years, and could barely leave at the end of that time. And it's a very seductive thing to live in a place with so many comforts, such natural beauty, such a lack of social need. I live in New York City now, and where you're constantly aware of your neighbor's needs. In Aspen, you never are. And there's something so blissful about it. It's so seductive. And I thought the best way to write this book would be to try and be honest about the ways in which I was sort of a little mean-spirited at the start and then got totally swept up in it. And at the very end, saw myself doing some sort of unpleasant things and decided it might be time to take a break.
I want to get back a little later to how Aspen seduced you and why you eventually left anyways.
Sure.
First, let me reintroduce you, and my guest is Ted Conover, author of the new book, Whiteout, Lost in Aspen. It's based on the 2 years that he spent living there, and he spent part of that time driving a taxi and part of that time working for a catering company and then part of the time working for the local newspaper. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer Ted Conover, whose new book is based on the couple of years that he spent living in Aspen. It's called Whiteout, Lost in Aspen. I want to get back to the idea of Aspen as a place where many celebrities live or go to vacation.
Uh-huh.
One of the most famous names associated with Aspen is John Denver, I mean, who even like adopted the name of the state for his own name.
Right.
Now, you very cleverly got to work as an extra on the John Denver Christmas special while you were there. It was called Christmas in Aspen.
That's right.
And then after working away at it for months, he finally granted you an interview. You have described John Denver as a New Age Oral Roberts. And you went to his New Age community, and you also went to a New Age conference
right. That
he sponsored called Choices.
Right.
And Choices is supposed to provide a chance to be our better selves.
Right.
You were skeptical about whether you could find out about your better self in such a kind of beautiful, controlled environment like Aspen.
Well, yeah, it's funny. You find that Aspen, in some ways, it's like going to church because while you're there, you know it's not likely anyone's going to do anything real mean to you. I mean, they're not going to cut you off in traffic like happens in a city or, there aren't going to be cross burnings in Aspen. There aren't going to be street people coming up to you at your glass of cappuccino and demanding money. It's that's what I mean when I say it's an easy place to see your better self or to feel your better self emerge.
None of your convictions will be tested in
exactly.
Any way.
There's an easy liberalism that comes there. And I'll never forget. Can I go and tell this
Please,
story?
Yeah.
I'll never forget the day I went to hear Jesse Jackson in Aspen, of all things. He spoke in the same ballroom where Don Johnson had his party. And he's hot on the campaign trail, and he scheduled his meeting or his rally for right after the ski lifts closed. So a lot of people came straight over, and here's this ballroom filled with people in ski suits. Some were even still wearing their ski boots. And here's Jesse Jackson with a pre-recorded rally tape saying, from Harlem to Watts, you know, from Detroit to Montgomery. We shall overcome. And everyone's cheering along, and you just think, this is too strange.
Tell me a little bit more what the seminar was like, the choice of seminar.
Windstar assembles a faculty, I guess you could call it, of people who either represent some hopeful strain in American culture or are prominent in the self-improvement and self-actualization movements. And they lecture, and you sit in a big tent, and people testify. It's sort of like a revival. John Denver has a wireless microphone and goes into the audience, and you get to meet him. And when you come to Windstar, it's like coming to Aspen. You get to meet all these people you recognize, and you get to go to a very intimate concert where John Denver sings, and he sounds better than ever. I mean, the guy's voice is great. And yet, at the end of it, you think, is this going to make any difference? And I have great skepticism about that.
What did you find most seductive about Aspen?
The number... I'm 33 years old and unmarried. And in Denver, where I grew up and which was my home base for a long time, I was feeling left out of the main flow of life by being 33 and unmarried in Denver. All my friends were getting married, having kids. And up in Aspen, to be in your 30s and unmarried practically means you're at the center of the action because so many other people are in exactly the same boat. So all of a sudden, you feel normative, you know? You feel like, this is just the place for me. And not only that, there's so many attractive people. I mean, it's quite staggering. I remember the day I was in the Aspen Times office with my friend Paul Anderson, who's a reporter there, and we were standing by the front desk where people come in to place their ads and everything. And I was getting to like Aspen enough that I'd bought myself some brightly colored fluorescent bicycling shorts with Nike emblazoned on the side. And I was, oh, God, I was wearing these sunglasses up on my head. I mean, only in Aspen would a reporter dress this way and get away with it. And there's dogs all around. You can bring your dog to work. And that's so fun to begin with right there. That's seductive. But then a friend of mine who's a ski instructor came in. This woman is so good looking. And she looked at how I was dressed and she said, Aspen's got you, Aspen's got you. I knew it would get you finally. You thought you'd just come to study it, but Aspen has you in its grip. And she was right.
You started to become a little suspicious about how well you were adjusting to Aspen, and I think this especially happened on your trips back to Denver.
Right.
Describe how you'd feel when you'd go back to Denver and suddenly, instead of just being surrounded by wealthy, healthy people, there was homelessness, there was crime, there were people of every, you know, social and economic class.
It was on these return trips home to Denver that I think I realized my better self was no longer emerging in Aspen, because I'd come down to Denver and it would look so plain and dirty, and you have to come in to the city through these industrial districts and the poor side of town, and there's all this air pollution, and I lived on a block in a low-income part of town where...
In Denver.
In Denver, right, where I had my apartment for much of the time I was in Aspen, just because I didn't want to give it up. And I'd get down and I'd be unloading my gear, you know. I'd take my skis off the car, take my mountain bike off the rack, and you look down the street and it was like the only car on the block with a rack on top. And I'd have all this stuff, the parkas, the gloves, the gear. Like, gear is what it's about. And I'd hurry up. I'd have to run to get it inside, because if you leave it outside there where I live, it'll get stolen. And I started to resent that. And I started to resent having to live in a place where you had to be a little bit apologetic about what you owned, or at least be cautious about it. In Aspen, that's not the case. You could probably leave your skis on the front lawn for a week and they'd be there when you got back.
So how hard was it to leave once you decided that you didn't like what was happening to you?
Totally hard. It's impossible. there's such a fright about leaving Aspen once you've been there so long, because you just know in many ways nothing is likely to be as exciting. Life was going to have, you're going to have to find some other compensations. But it was so much money to live there and stay there, and so much pressure in certain ways to dress well, to stay fit, to eat in a healthy way. I mean, all of these in a way are good things, but taken to extremes, they can be bad. And I enjoy having that pressure off now.
You know, we've talked a little bit about what crises of conscience it caused in you to be in a very upper-class, celebrity-oriented environment. Did you go through different kinds of crises of conscience when you were traveling with hobos or with illegal immigrants? Because, let's face it, you were from the middle class.
Definitely, definitely. With hobos in particular, by hobos I mean railroad hobos who travel on freight trains. And my aim was to learn what their life was like. But there was one thing which ensured that I would never really know. That is, I could learn a lot about it, but I would never be in the situation they're in of not being able to go home. And as a middle-class person, this is something I treasured, is the ability to go home and have a door that locked and have a phone that rang and mail that arrived and comforts like that. I felt guilty about that when I was out there, during my first couple months especially. Later on, I cherished those things. In the same way I cherish my teeth, I started brushing my teeth sort of obsessively because I saw how all these older guys lost their teeth. And it was one of the things that made me distant from them, you know. They could see I had all my teeth were straight, you know. They didn't know, but my teeth had been straightened, and it was one of those insurmountable barriers that at the beginning you may feel bad about, but later on you feel glad to have.
Well, Ted Conover, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And Ted Conover is the author of the new book, Whiteout, Lost in Aspen, and it's based on 2 years that he spent living in Aspen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what's the latest news that you have about hostages?
Alan Steen is out, Terry, a teacher at Beirut University College, and things are moving very quickly. There are reports on the wires now that reliable sources are saying that Terry Anderson, the American who has been held since March of 1985, has been handed to a neutral third party and is on his way through the process out. So we're watching that. We're also watching the Soviet Union, where President Mikhail Gorbachev has threatened dire consequences, even including an end to world peace if the Union breaks up, the Soviet Union breaks up. Also, more on water in the Middle East.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. All year long, there have been events commemorating the bicentennial of Mozart's death, which actually comes around this Thursday. There have also been many books reassessing the composer's life and legacy. There's a new novel about Mozart by Anthony Burgess called On Mozart. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
When he is good, the prolific and promiscuous Anthony Burgess is an angel of a writer, as in A Clockwork Orange, or Enderby Outside, or Earthly Powers. When he's bad, he's a brat, as in his wicked list of 99 great novels, or his quite odious obituary trashing Graham Greene. Most of the time, he's in between, being clever. That he should write a book on Mozart in this bicentennial year of the composer's death is no surprise. Burgess has written several novels about geniuses, like Shakespeare and Napoleon and Jesus, and he's also a composer himself. That he has written this particular book about Mozart means that he's being Burgess, both an angel and a brat. We have in one volume several imaginary conversations in heaven, among the likes of Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Wagner, Rossini, Berlioz, Schoenberg, Gershwin, and Stendhal. Stendhal, yes, and keep your eye on him, he'll be back. There's the libretto of an opera about Mozart in Vienna insulting his patrons. There's a screenplay about Mozart, his father, his rival Salieri, the Queen of Prussia, and other lowlifes. There's a schizophrenic dialogue between someone named Anthony and someone named Burgess, who disagree about everything. Meanwhile, Lorenzo De Ponte makes fun of Henry James. And in the middle of all of this, before we finally get to what Burgess himself really thinks about Mozart and his bicentennial, and music, and literature, and history, there is also a short story, purportedly by Stendhal, which seems to be set more or less among the aristocracy on the eve of the French Revolution, and which is intended to mimic, in thematic prose, Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. This is a romp. I like hearing Mendelssohn talk about Beethoven's Bow Wow style, or Wagner saying that musical notes can be a river, a sword, a funeral pyre, a horse, or Gershwin's telling us that the chromatic scale is not in nature and you know it, or if it is, it's too high up the harmonic series to make sense except to bats. Like Burgess, I believe that music is all verbs, and I like his comparison of Mozart with such literary counterparts as Balzac in France, H.G. Wells in England, and remarkably, Dante in Italy and in Paradise. I even like his doggerel. If I'm not quite as impressed by Burgess being Stendhal being symphonic, it's because Garcia Marquez has already written a full-length novel, Autumn of the Patriarch, based on Bartok's six-string quartets. The heavenly conversations remind me too much of Milan Kundera's in his last novel, Immortality, which also had similar things to say about sentimentality and vulgarity, and said them better than Burgess does. There's also some pernicious Islam bashing, but this is Burgess being Eurocentric bratty, the hall monitor at the Vatican. He clearly loves Mozart, after whom civilization went into a decline. And if his explanation why isn't exactly a symphony, an opera, or a requiem mass of verbs, but more a crackerjack box of rondos and scherzos, counterpoint, cantabile, and minuet, well, there was only one Amadeus, and he died so young that we still feel lousy about it, and it's wonderful to be told here that he's teaching God to play the harpsichord.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed On Mozart by Anthony Burgess. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Sue Spolin, Sue Weinstein, and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We used to know how to care for the dying at home, but now the idea frightens many of us. On the next Fresh Air, medical anthropologist Andrea Sankar tells us why more Americans are taking their loved ones home to die. And she remembers her own experience taking care of her dying mother. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.